live here in the studio. So we're going to bid you farewell. Happy journeys. Make sure you call KBOO News if there's any breaking stories to give us news reports about what's going on there. And we look forward to talking to you in a month again.
Sure. All right. Thanks, Tom.
All right. And that was Jacqueline Keeler. And this has been the Pollen Nation Report edition of Wednesday Talk Radio here on KBOO Community Radio, KBOO Portland. Thanks.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Crybaby, produced and performed by Stageworks, Inc. Crybaby will take place at the Clinton Street Theater Friday and Saturday, October 14th and 15th at 7:30 p.m. and Sunday, October 16th at 2 p.m. Crybaby Live is a rockabilly musical homage to the John Waters cult classic film set in the 1950s in Baltimore. Again, that's Crybaby, the play, at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, October 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library in Corvallis. The interactive and multimedia iBook is a collaboration between the Oboe Addy Legacy Project and the OSU Oregon Multicultural Archives to showcase the history and current community outreach of the Oboe Addy Legacy Project. Again, that's the Taste of Chives Oboe Addy Legacy Project iBook launch and potluck on Friday, February 21st at noon at Oregon State University Valley Library, 3rd floor Willamette Room, 201 Southwest Waldo Place in Corvallis. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good morning. It is now 9:01 on a beautiful Wednesday morning, and you are tuned in to KBOO Portland. Coming up this morning on The Boo at 9:30, we'll hear an interview with professor and white rage author Carol Anderson about structural racism in the U.S. At 10, it's Air Cascadia headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with journalist Robert Perry about the presidential debates, the U.S. media, and the danger of nuclear war, and will present some highlights from Monday's Indigenous Peoples Day sunrise celebration. And finally, at 11 on The Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert discuss the many different ways gardeners can use leaves, harvesting fall fruits and veggies. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. Not a current member? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And now, next, coming up, it's Kathleen Stevenson on Political Perspectives, who will speak with supporters of the campaign finance measure that Multnomah County voters will consider this November. Kathleen?
Thank you, Patsy. This is Kathleen Stevenson for Political Perspectives, and with me in studio are Moses Ross and Jason Kafori. They are both on the steering committee with the Honest Elections campaign in favor of Measure 26184, which is a Multnomah County ballot referral to reduce the influence of large campaign contributions and expenditures on candidate elections and to increase the information available to voters on the sources and amounts of political campaign funding. Moses Ross, welcome.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here again.
And Jason Kafori, also welcome.
It's a pleasure. Thanks.
And we are going to start with Moses Ross because he was on the Charter Review Commission that brought this measure to the fore. So give us some background on how this measure came to be.
Absolutely. First off, to the Multnomah County, Multnomah County is very unique in that every 6 years, we hold a what's referred to as a charter review, where they go in and review the charter, which is in essence the bylaws, how we govern the county, the guidelines for the county, the bylaws. And a committee is formed comprised of regular citizens that have been appointed by their state representative and their state senator, representing all areas of Multnomah County. And we convene this committee every 6 years to review the bylaws of Multnomah County, and with one premise: is something broken? And if something is broken, how do we fix it? At using the bylaws. So not everything that is wrong with the county, the perceived wrongs of the county, can be addressed through the bylaws, but many of them can. For instance, so what has happened is that we convene, we make recommendations to improve what we feel are problems with the current bylaws that govern the county, and the commissioners put them on the ballot. They're presented to the commission. They are not vetted by the commissioners. They are put straight to the ballot for the voters to decide. So it's a unique method of
Democracy.
Of democracy. Yes, absolutely, Jason. That's exactly right. It's the idea that a citizen-ran committee can make these suggestions and improvements and allow for a vote by the people to make these changes. And so every 6 years this happens. And so this year I was honored to be a member of that committee representing my neighborhood and my community out there in House District 38. And we tackled a couple of different issues. One of them was campaign finance reform. We felt that there was a problem in Multnomah County with big money being involved in politics and potentially hurting democracy in Multnomah County through that influence of that big money. And so we had a subcommittee that did the background on this, and we found that there are many models that can be used nationwide that can be adapted here in Multnomah County. And so after taking a look at all of the different options that we had, knowing that we had the basic problem that could be addressed through those bylaw, through a change in those bylaws, we came to consensus with the approach that is currently on the ballot. It came out unanimously in our subcommittee of five, and it passed with a majority in the full committee, ironically.
7-6.
Majority is a majority. And it does kind of go to show the institutional resistance to this type of a fundamental change in how our democracy is, because it is so unique. You know, so I was fine with the fact that it was a close vote. Point is, though, it's on the ballot. And now we as Multnomah County voters have an opportunity to make a real fundamental change to how elections are ran and financed here in Multnomah County. And quite frankly, this will be a model nationwide once we get this passed in November. And that to me is the most exciting part of this, is that this is something that can be pointed to and say, okay, this is where we started in Multnomah County. Multnomah County voters took a stand and made a change.
Okay.
Absolutely.
And I want to get later, I want to ask you about that close vote, but let's get to what that measure actually does with Jason. I think you
sure
can explain that.
Yeah, there are a couple different parts to the measure. First, we in Oregon are just one of a handful of states in the entire country that have no limits at all on campaign contributions to candidates. So if I want to write a big check, as we saw recently, Phil Knight just donated $80,000 to a state house race candidate, $50,000 to multiple other ones. You can in Oregon. So what this would do is create limits of $500 per person for Multnomah County races only. So that would be for the commissioners, the chair, the auditor, the sheriff. It would not apply to the city council races, and it would not apply to state races. It would also ban corporate contributions. It would also limit independent expenditures, kind of that dark money that, you know, people want to spend money on races. This would limit that to $5,000. And in addition, I think one of the sort of more exciting parts about it is that it creates an empowerment of small donors by allowing organizations such as unions or nonprofit groups to form small donor committees so that their members at $100 per person can still contribute to candidates, but we're keeping out, you know, the $50,000 checks, you know, from an organization in which is part of the big problem that we have currently. And the other part that I think is kind of exciting, it would require that in your advertising, you identify who are your top five biggest donors. Now, if the contribution limits are there, that wouldn't be as big of a play. But there was a really great story recently where California, who's had this exact or very similar disclosure requirement for many years, had a race where I think it was Riverside, California, Chevron decided to run a whole slate of candidates, and they, in each of their advertisements, they had to put paid for by Chevron against these other city council folks that weren't being funded by Chevron. And the entire Chevron slate, even though they massively outspent the other folks, lost. So, you know, it shows you that when voters know who's really paying for elections, it makes a big difference. And those are some of those are the basic provisions of what this would do for Multnomah County.
Right.
What's exciting to me about all of this, though, is the empowerment to the individual voter that this kind of this reform will create, because it puts it all out there for the voter to know. It caps it. It levels the playing field for an individual versus an entity in contributions and how they contribute to a candidacy, and it forces the candidates to have to go talk to voters individually if they want to, well, quite frankly, raise money from those same voters. You have to talk to the voters. And that's such an anomaly nowadays with these folks that are writing 50K checks that are able to dictate the outcome because of that. I mean, let me give you a great example of that, and that's in the most recent chair's race for county commission. Over $460,000 was spent on that race by the eventual winner. And so that concerned us at the committee level, whether or not that intense of an influence on a candidacy, on an election, is good for the individuals. And we decided it was not. Mm-hmm. And so we had an opportunity to make a fundamental change and to me, what is very important is that this reflects the values of Multnomah County. And there's definitely a precedent for taking an action as one would say radical, one would also say as fair, of an action to this means against legal or popular or legal precedent. Back in the Mean Girls, back in the Multnomah County Commission, when they passed against legal precedent, gay marriage licenses. So it's the idea that we take the forefront here in Multnomah County because we do things that reflect our values, and campaign finance reform is right there on the top of the list.
Yeah, and you know what's amazing about Oregon, you know, as I said, we're one of a handful of states with no contribution limits. We were recently ranked by the Center for Public Integrity 49th, just only ahead of Mississippi in political financing of our elections. Now we think of ourselves as this progressive, you know, leading state and county for a vision and for ideas. Well, it's time for our campaign finance laws and the rules of our elections to catch up to the rest of the country, frankly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about, and it reflects what you talked about earlier, Moses, with the close vote. I don't know, but I was trying to find, you know, what is the opposition to this measure? Is there any? And the only thing I found in a Tribune article was some quote from County Commissioner Loretta Smith saying that in opposition to the measure. Was that part of and let me just say that she said races tend to be friendly toward women and minorities. minorities and handicapping these candidates would obstruct them from successfully running for higher office.
The commissioner did come and testify to the full commission, taking that perspective in against this proposal, against this measure. I did find it curious, though, and head-scratching that her perspective of how she felt that this would actually suppress diversity and suppress opportunity for folks of color, and in the sense that the current situation requires that a person be ingrained into the current system and have the networks within the current communities, political communities. And if you don't have those networks, you can't, it's very difficult to penetrate it. I think a good example is what's going on right now in the Portland City Council race. You know, someone that is very well connected versus someone that is just a community activist that doesn't have as depth of the connections.
Are you talking about Chloe Udaly?
I am. I'm referring to that race. So I point to that as an example of how the current system makes it much more difficult for folks of color and for folks in minority communities to be able to penetrate that big white wall of elected office. And our measure does the complete opposite. It encourages that one-on-one conversation. It encourages people in the communities to get out there and to express their opinions. And if it resonates with the community, if it is on par with what the community feels, how the community feels, they're going to get the $100, they're going to get the contributions, they're going to be a viable candidate versus right now.
Yeah, the truth is that there's only a handful of people in this entire state that donate money. I mean, people that donate money to politicians, you know, it's the 1%. And what we've seen in our country in the last 20 or 30 years is a massive, massive rise in inequality. And because of that rise of inequality, people are going to those same donors every time for money. And so we need more balance. That's the bottom line. We need more balance. We need to level the playing field. And the way to start that process is to create rules that everybody has to play by. And you can't go, if your campaign's not doing well, and go get, you know, a five, you know, or even a six-figure check from somebody. That's not fair fundamentally. And I don't think it's good for our democracy. And I think that's what this will help begin.
Yeah.
That's Jason Kafoury, and also with us is Moses Ross. They are with the Steering Committee of Honest Elections, the campaign in favor of Measure 26-184. That's the Multnomah County ballot referral. And I wanted to also ask about how this fits in with the Citizens United ruling. How will this interact with that?
Well, Citizens United did not actually address the question of contribution limits. So where we are right now is there's a state Supreme Court decision from, I think, 1997, where they equated free speech and money and decided that you couldn't have caps on donations because it violated our free speech clause. Well, the legal reality is that 38 other states across the country have the exact same free speech language in their state constitution, but they have contribution limits. So I think that it's ripe now for a challenge to that. And I anticipate this will likely have a challenge, but we look forward to that challenge because, you know, things have changed over the last 20 years. There's a lot more money in politics. And it's also, you know, I think with the Bernie Sanders campaign and sort of focusing on the problem of the inequality in our society, I think that minds have changed about money in politics. And, you know, frankly, what Citizens United did is it flooded the big dark money into our campaigns. And now we're seeing, you know, it costs billions to run for president. As an example here, I think this is a great example of money in politics. In Oregon, back in the 70s, people would spend $3,000-$4,000 to run for a state rep race. Now, a state rep race in Oregon could cost over $750,000 to run for office. That's way ahead of inflation. So, I mean, you're seeing that it's time to pull the reins back on big money. And, you know, this, we're hoping that this is a model. We're hoping that other cities and counties across the state adopt something similar to this. And we're hoping that this will lead to an effort in 2018 and beyond to create statewide campaign finance reform.
And one quick note to that. We knew on the committee level, we were aware that there was potentially going to be a legal challenge to this measure. And we welcomed it. After reviewing the pros and the cons, the inequality versus the opportunity here, we knew this going into it, and it still passed. You know, there's been polls that have shown over 70% of the people in Multnomah County want campaign finance reform, agree with the concept of campaign finance reform. So that's not the issue. The issue is the methodology. And if we have to wait for the vested interest to propose this, we're going to be waiting a long time.
And I will add, what's really interesting about campaign finance reform, it polls really well both with the left and the right. It's not an issue that is just where progressives are. You know, I think there was something about should there be contribution limits recently, and it was somewhere like 85% of Democrats, but also like 70 or 75% of Republicans support it too. So, you know, we think this is universally a popular idea, that people are sick and tired of having big money run our election system, and this is our chance in Multnomah County to take a stand. I would like to add, for folks that would like more information on this, they can go to our website, honest-elections.com, honest-elections.com. We've got a resources tab that sort of outlines the entire problem for citizens.
And I wanted to ask you about how you're garnering support for this measure. I know you have a rally coming up. Do you want to talk about that, Jason?
We have built actually a really strong coalition. The Multnomah County Democratic Party and several third parties, the Progressive Party, the Independent Party, the Green Party, have all, and Working Families Party, have all endorsed this measure. So we have a pretty wide coalition of political parties behind it. I think there's about 30 or 40 organizations, including the NAACP, Portland Chapter, the Sierra Club, that are behind our effort. So we've built up a big coalition. We actually got 21 voter pamphlet statements in the voter pamphlets in support of our measure. And there's no opposition in the voter pamphlet statement, except for one that we did ourselves. It's a little tongue in cheek, but we're doing a big grassroots effort. We're doing a big social media push. We are doing lawn sign campaign. If anybody would like a lawn sign, they can go to our website and give us a call. We've got another couple hundred of those to get out, and we're having a big rally in support of the measure and campaign finance reform generally. Saturday, October 22nd, Ralph Nader is actually going to be in Portland. He's doing a book signing at Powell's at noon, and then he's going to come and give a speech. The theme of the event is getting big money out of politics. Amanda Fritz is also going to speak on behalf of her public financing effort that's going to come up for a vote here right after the election. And we are urging anybody who'd like to come and join the campaign and hear more about this problem to come. The doors open at 6 o'clock. Event starts at 7, and it's at the Downtown First Unitarian Church, which is at 1211 Southwest Main Street. It should be a lot of fun.
Oh, it's going to be a pretty good time. I mean, we have a good, the topic transcends any ideological disagreements that parties may have. And that, to me, is what's so satisfying about this and gives me confidence that this is going to pass. But it is up to the listener to get out there, vote. You got to vote, man. You got to vote.
And if you can help us with a donation, we'd love that too. Campaigns do cost money. We're doing mailings. We're doing all kinds of stuff for the campaign.
At this moment in time, we're still under the old system. So we are accepting donations to get this to get this out. So, but yes, what a great opportunity for you to come out, ask questions, come see Ralph Nader, listen to Amanda Fritz's proposal, throw us a couple of dollars so that we can continue the fight.
Yeah.
I know you said earlier that you talked about the other states and how there are some measures that are sort of like this.
At least.
Have you been in communication with other municipalities or other areas where this kind of measure has been in effect or is on a ballot somewhere?
It's a good question. You know, where a lot of this started, the energy around this, was in Seattle last year in November. Seattle got some some big organizations nationally, represent.us, a group called Every Voice, and these are folks that have resources. They have pretty big budgets, and they want to start implementing campaign finance reform at the local level across the country. They realize that federally, it's broken. Nothing's happening in Washington, D.C. right now. And they realize that at the state level, a lot's not happening. So they have switched their efforts now locally to initiatives and to city and county efforts. So, yes, there are several efforts happening all across the country. We've been in touch with some of the national organizers about this, these efforts. The Seattle model was really interesting. They came up with a contribution limit for city council races of $500, and that was part of the impetus of why we chose $500 for this effort, because it matched what Seattle had just passed. They also put several good governance pieces there. You know, lobbyists couldn't turn around and go. Candidates couldn't turn around and become lobbyists, and those sort of revolving door issues. One of the more interesting parts about the Seattle effort was they had a public financing system where every voter got $100. It would come as a voucher, and they could give it to a candidate if they decided, or not. And so that's going to get implemented next year in Seattle. And it's a really interesting way to try to engage more people with the process. So we saw that the Seattle measure passed 63%. And again, almost no organized opposition to that measure in Seattle. So I think that was a big impetus for this. And now that the same good governance thing is statewide in Washington, is going to be on this November ballot, that same $100 per voter. I think it applies to state house races there. There's also an effort in South Dakota to pass campaign finance reform. That's a really good, you know, Washington State is thought of as this progressive place. South Dakota is the conservative state. So it'll be really interesting to see this November how that happens.
You know, one thing I do want to point out as well is that our efforts here in Oregon, we're very autonomous from all other efforts because of the nature of how this measure got on the ballot through the Charter Review Committee. As the Charter Review, it was our task to be as independent and neutral as possible, but yet if there was a problem that we identified with the Charter, to come up with a way to fix it. And so looking at it through that prism, we saw what had happened in Seattle. We saw the benefits that they were having, the empowerment that Seattle's proposal had given their voters. And so we were confident enough in that, from that, to use it as kind of the structure of what we proposed to put onto the ballot from the committee. Now, you'll notice that in ours, we don't have public financing. We decided against that public financing aspect. Quite frankly, on the committee level, it was because we wanted this to pass. And we felt that the financing would be a bridge too far, at least at this point. So
also, you know, I think that there was a lot of people that knew that there was an effort at the city level to get public financing. And so, you know, and I would say that, you know, we've been working with folks that are active with the Bernie Sanders former campaign. We've been working with a lot of grassroots organizations that are active on the public financing effort, too. So I view this ship as, in an ideal world, you'd have caps on contributions, you'd have public financing so that candidates could spend more time talking to voters, but be able to have the resources to run an effective campaign. And I think that's an ideal model where I'd like to see our local community get to.
Absolutely. But we've got to get the steps to get there, though. We felt on the committee level we had to start somewhere, and this basic structure we felt confident would get passed. Mm-hmm. If we put the financing in there, gosh, there's such a contentiousness over there with that. And quite frankly, I bet you a dollar in a year or two, there's going to be an integration between what's happening with the city and with the county, especially if this passes. Knock on wood, that could happen.
Okay, Moses Ross and Jason Kafoury, we just have a minute or so left here. I want to get, again, the website for people who are interested in connecting with you about the measure and maybe saying the number of the measure.
That would probably be a good idea. We actually got the endorsement of the Willamette Week this morning, but they switched the number around. So just so everybody's clear, it's vote yes on measure 26-184. Measure 26-184. Website is honest-elections.com. And for anybody who'd like to get plugged into the campaign, please join our effort. We really would love your support, and we'd love to have you come on Saturday, October 22nd, to the big rally we're having with Ralph Nader at the Downtown Unitarian Church at 7 o'clock.
Okay, great. Thank you so much for coming in and talking about this and informing us. Thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having us.
And this has been the first part of Political Perspectives here on KBOO Portland. I'm Kathleen Stevenson, and again, I've been speaking with Jason Kafoury and Moses Ross, both with the steering committee of the Honest Elections campaign in favor of Measure 26-184. Coming up next on this program, we're going to hear author and professor Carol Anderson, who joins the Project Censored show to discuss structural racism in the U.S., especially in the context of the presidential campaign.
Welcome back to the Project Censored show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're going to welcome back Professor Carol Anderson. Her most recent book is White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. We're going to talk about structural racism in the U.S., and in particular, we'll be talking about election politics.
Carol Anderson is a Samuel Kyandor Dobbs Professor of African American Studies at Emory University. She's the author of the book White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide in the United States. Carol, welcome.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter, and thank you, Mickey.
It's great to have you back on. The main theme of your book, that since 1865, in the passage of the 13th Amendment, every time African Americans have made advances towards full participation in our democracy, white reaction has fueled a deliberate and relentless rollback on their gains. Certainly the end of the Civil War, Reconstruction was greeted with black codes and the Jim Crow. The Supreme Court, 1954, Brown versus Board of Education, was met with a shutting down of public schools throughout the South. And so these kind of continued. We're in an election here, and one of the candidates is saying, let's make America great again. What does that say to you in terms of white rage?
Oh, it speaks to a longing, wistfulness, yearning, desire, burning passion for what they consider to be the good old days. But if you nail down what those good old days are, so you say, so when was America great? Because if you're going to be great again, you've got to ask that first question. And they come up with things like, well, 1913. And you'll look at them and you'll say, well, 1913, you know that African Americans and women couldn't vote in 1913. Oh, yeah, right. Or they'll say 1776. You mean when America still had slavery? So what I hear in Make America Great Again is a kind of nostalgia masked in terms of patriotism that is about, in fact, creating an apartheid state. It's that as they look at an America that is becoming increasingly racially and ethnically diverse, that it's to figure out how to use the levers of state, the levers of policy, the levers of government, in order to cordon off access to resources to those diverse populations. That's what's behind this. Race is running through this campaign in the most open and barely coded ways.
Well, Carol Anderson, I remember when we spoke last time, you had a pretty eloquent phrase about the language that's part of dog whistle politics, right? A more coded language of racism and hierarchical language. But as you just illustrated, in the case of the Donald Trump candidacy in the Republican Party in particular, it's almost as if the dog whistle is gone.
Oh, yes. I wrote a piece that talked about that, where it was like the reason why the GOP is really angry with Trump is that he has exposed the way that white rage drives policy. He doesn't use dog whistles. In fact, he just barks. and those barks in a really weird way then allow his supporters to go, what? What are you talking about? So, for instance, in one of the debates, Trump said that I'm willing to use language that no one else is willing to use, and that is law and order. And we have to have stop and frisk.
And in fact, Carol Anderson, that was his response to a question from the moderator about race in America.
Yes.
I mean, that was his reaction.
Again, that is so barely coded. So how do we deal with healing the racial divide in America? We need law and order. We need to pour more police officers into black and brown communities.
That's laying it pretty bare. And you alluded to this, of course, earlier, the quote-unquote make America great again, meaning back before there were civil rights movements, back before the government was pushed to get involved in trying to create something that even resembled a remotely equal opportunity society, particularly for people of color.
Yes. I mean, so there was a recent study done that showed that it would take 228 years for African Americans to equal the wealth that whites hold. Now, begin to think about that. That's about 9 generations to get to the same level of wealth that whites currently hold. But yet we have this angst coursing through the American body politic that sees their hold on the kind of economic and social hierarchy slipping. Now, begin to think through how fevered that has to be when 228 years isn't enough.
And this is something else that's not really discussed at all. You rarely see this kind of analysis or commentary in corporate media. And the other part of this that's striking is that in Donald Trump, we don't see enough people, in my estimation, calling out this very uncoded language. And again, your example from the debate was the response to the racial divide was stop and frisk, and then used erroneous statistics on arrest rates and so forth. And the press, you'll remember, Lester Holt said it wasn't his job to fact check candidates.
Right. And so when Lester then tried to step in and go, actually, stop and frisk was found unconstitutional. No, it wasn't. But yes, it was.
Yeah.
And it was also ineffective. And that's the piece that doesn't get fully explored. So in New York, where Donald Trump's minion, Rudy Giuliani, ruled for a while and really implemented what was known as the broken windows theory of policing that led to stop and frisk, which is that hyper-policing in poorer communities, particularly black and brown communities, that overwhelmingly, disproportionately, African Americans and Latinos were stopped in rates that were so far above their proportion in the population. However, the bulk of the illegal drugs and illegal weapons were found on the handful of whites. So if this policy was really about law enforcement, you would see targeting at those populations that are yielding the greatest yield of weaponry and drugs. But instead, the targeting is going to the populations that are bringing about the least amount. So that tells you that stop and frisk is not about law enforcement. It is about the intimidation and the criminalization of the black and brown populations in the United States. And that's what Donald Trump wants. That's what Make America Great Again means to him and his supporters.
So, Carol, certainly the prison complex and the millions of people in jail disproportionately of color and the inability in many states to vote once you've been convicted of a felony is part of what you would call a kind of a continuation of Jim Crow laws. Is that correct?
Oh, absolutely. One of the pieces that I lay out in White Rage is how do you begin to strip the power out of the civil rights movement, particularly the Civil Rights Act of 64 and the Voting Rights Act of 65. And it was the way that Nixon led with law and order, and then Reagan really amped it up with the war on drugs. So where we stand right now is that we have 2.2 million African Americans disfranchised because of felony convictions, which is 7.7% of African American people who are eligible to vote.
And we also know, Carol Anderson, based on that, you go back in several elections, particularly the historically contentious 2000 election, where Democrats still want to blame Ralph Nader as a spoiler, which is completely fallacious in my view based on the evidence. But there were 58,000 African Americans purged from the voter rolls in South Florida.
And this is the thing that we're seeing as well. So you take felony disfranchisement and then you add to that these voter ID laws, and you add to that the elimination of early voting, and you add to that the purge. So here in Georgia, for instance, part of what we know is that our right to vote is our right to vote, except in Georgia, where if you haven't voted, say, in the past four elections or so, the Secretary of State begins to remove your name from the voting list. Now, it's not like you have a felony conviction. It's just that you haven't voted. So at what point did the fact that I didn't vote then strip me of the right to vote? But in Georgia, you have this massive purge of the voter list based on that erroneous and fallacious assumption. That's what's going on, the systematic way to figure out how do we roll back the citizenship rights of American citizens, the rights of American citizens to choose their own government, to choose their own representatives, because at its core, that's what disfranchisement is. They dress it up in language of voter fraud. But a while back, where it came out that Scott Walker up in Wisconsin, as they're dealing with his recall election, and emails are going back and forth, and one of the emails says, you know, it might be time, this election might be a little close, so it might be time to start the PR piece on voter fraud so we can get out that language right now. So then when we have to do a recount, the ground has already been tilled. Now, again, no evidence of voter fraud, but it is a PR piece. It is marketing. It is language to drive fear that somehow the ballot box is being tampered with.
Indeed, this is the same in Florida. You write about this in your book, White Rage. You have a chapter called How to Unelect a Black President. Rick Scott, in fact, using that same kind of Orwellian language or doublespeak about how they simply have an interest in protecting the integrity of the vote, and they're protecting the ballot box and democracy by making it more difficult to commit, quote, voter fraud, right? And but we have almost no cases of voter fraud, yet we have massive evidence of election fraud.
Yes. You know, so a law professor in California did a study that from 2000 to 2014, he found 31 cases of voter fraud out of 1 billion votes. And that's B like in Carl Sagan, billions and billions. Jeez. So 31 out of 1 billion. That is the quote-unquote rampant voter fraud epidemic that has led 36 states to implement these laws that restrict access to the ballot box.
And that's an example of a dog whistle type of policy that's masked insidiously. And again, you write about Acorn, too. We'd like to talk a little bit about that. And I know Peter wants to jump back in here and talk more about some of the current election. But I would like to remind listeners that we are speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. She is at Emory University, and she is author most recently of a book titled White Rage: The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. You're listening to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. We will return our conversation with Carol Anderson after this brief musical break. Stay with us. Welcome back to the Project Censored Show on Pacifica Radio. I'm Mickey Huff with Peter Phillips. We're speaking with Professor Carol Anderson. Her most recent book, White Rage, The Unspoken Truth of Our Racial Divide. Before the break, we were talking about election fraud versus voter fraud. And Carol Anderson, you also write about the takedown of Acorn in your piece. Can you tie that together?
Acorn had been doing an amazing job of registering the heretofore unregistered to vote, going into communities and really working hard to bring about this kind of full engagement in the election process. That was a threat because the people that Acorn was registering were those that White Rage does not want to vote. And Acorn had a few people who didn't really want to do that hard work of going into the community and registering people to vote. And so they just forged voter registration cards. But not clever forgeries. They weren't trying to, like, get over in that way. They knew they were getting paid per voter registration. So they would fill out cards with names like Mickey Mouse, Donald Duck. But the laws require that those who are registering people to vote have to turn in all of the cards into the Board of Elections. So that's what Acorn did, but alerted the board that there are some bogus cards in there. So again, Acorn is doing what it's supposed to do. It's not saying, hey, here are all of the cards. It's alerting the state that some of these cards are bogus, but they're following the law. That became, it's not even a smoking gun, the excuse that was then used to vilify, demonize, and destroy Acorn to the point where Acorn no longer exists, but a recent poll showed that some large percentage of Trump supporters were convinced that Acorn was going to sabotage this election. That's the level of demonization that happened after the 2008 election. And so you take that, and they then used these state legislatures and these governors, then used the kind of ominous presence of Acorn as an excuse to justify the language of voter fraud and then all of these voter suppression laws. So you take something that is bogus and then you create an apparatus to do the work that you wanted to do all along but couldn't quite get away with. And you see things like in Texas. Texas knew that in over 200 counties, they only had departments of motor vehicles in 81 of them, but yet are requiring a government-issued photo ID. So if you know that you don't have access for that ID for all of your people, then it behooves you to provide that access. But that's not what Texas did. In fact, Texas's legislature, when they were drafting SB2, they put through a rider that said, we realize that some of our citizens will have to drive 250 miles of travel to get this government-issued photo ID. So we need to reimburse them for that. And the state legislature put a mark through that saying, no, we don't. So then what you really have operating here is a poll tax. So in so many ways, what this moment has crystallized for us is how the tools of subjugation, discrimination, and racism in the Jim Crow era are now being dressed up and refined in this era and marketed as something that is supposed to protect democracy.
Carol Anderson, the polls on Donald Trump continue to be relatively close to the Democratic candidate. To what extent do you believe that's driven by white rage?
This is an unscientific poll, but I'm thinking something close to 99.999%.
Pretty close to 100%.
Yeah, and let me give you a reason why. That's not quite as facetious, but there has been work in trying to understand who are Trump supporters. And we get that narrative that these are the disaffected. These are struggling white workers who are in states where factories have shut down and it's just really hard for them. Well, a deeper dive into that has shown that, in fact, his porters make over $70,000 a year on average. Mm-hmm. And in America, that's not struggling. So all of the pieces about economic angst are not based in this kind of reality of where they are. It deals more with this fear that as African Americans and as Hispanics began to move further and deeper into their access to their rights in American society, which will mean access to resources that have been closed and walled off from them, that whites' ability to maintain their privilege, to maintain their social status, their hierarchy, will be threatened.
Carol Anderson, I wanted to also mention our 40th anniversary at Project Censored is this year. Our new book, Censored 2017, is out. And one of the things that we did in our deja vu, looking back at previously censored or underreported stories, we go back and we look historically at some key issues and see where are they now. We looked at a July 2014 poll conducted by CBS, and it found that 8 in 10 polled believed that there was real progress for ending racial discrimination, and 19% of those polled said that there hadn't been. However, when that nearly 80% majority was broken down along racial lines, only 59% of Black Americans believed that real progress had been made, compared to 82% of whites. And that's what's not reported.
Right. And it's because it deals as well with the kind of consistent racism that African Americans face, even in a so-called post-racial society. The difference in pay. So a recent analysis came out that showed, regardless of education, African Americans consistently earn less than whites. Another study, they held everything constant. They held education, they held the type of education, they held constant type of employment. They held everything constant and still found these massive gaps in income between blacks and whites. And the only way that the researchers could account for those sizable gaps after all of those issues of qualify are held constant was racism. And blacks know it, but when African Americans say racism, the response in American society is, there you go, just whining again, and all you've got to do is just obey the law. All you've got to do is just go to school.
All lives matter. That's the same kind of coded language.
Exactly. Exactly. And so think about this. When the killings of black people by police and the use of the cameras, I've heard it said over and over again, those images aren't for the black community. We know we're being killed. Those images are to show whites in America that you can have your hands up, be absolutely as non-threatening as you can be, and you will be shot. Now, think about how tragic that is, that to be able to experience racism to the point where it gets you killed, but nobody believes what you're saying in this society. And that's how powerful this coded language, these dog whistles are. So when Trump can say, well, the way we heal the racial divide is law and order and stop and frisk.
Certainly that is an issue that police are very concerned about. And we've seen Fraternal Order of Police, a number of police unions supporting Trump openly.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, the continued militarization of the police is part of that.
Yes.
But deep inside of police unions, particularly those that were traditionally white, firefighters, police, big city jobs, was the history in the 70s of taking that into consideration under affirmative action kinds of hiring, where broad-based recruitment was done for all races to have them take tests and become qualified for jobs, the resentment that continues in white male America towards anything that smacks of affirmative action implies to them that they're being discriminated against, even though the law is quite clear that it's discrimination based on race, and it includes white people. So you think that's a major part of what we're seeing here in this election cycle?
I think it is a piece of it. I mean, it is the piece, for instance, is that it's not just in the police force. Think about Abigail Fisher in Texas, who was the young woman who wanted to go to the University of Texas, but she didn't have the grades or the standardized test scores, the SATs, to get in into the top 10% of her graduating class in order to get automatic admission. And she didn't also make the second tier. And in that second tier of admissions into UT Austin, they take race into consideration, but it's not the alpha and the omega of the consideration. And so there were like 47 additional students admitted under the second tier for UT Austin. Only five of those were African-American or Latino. But she claimed that though somebody, one of those five, took her slot. The fact that there were African-Americans and Latinos who had greater GPAs and higher test scores than her who also weren't admitted was irrelevant. And so it becomes this thing where, you know, and this is why I talked about at the beginning of our program, a level of territorial exclusion to the resources in American society. So the good jobs with pensions, because that's what those police jobs are. That's what those firefighter jobs are. They're an element of middle class stability that many who are working class no longer have, because we no longer have the level of unionization that we used to have in American society. But those positions still provide that. And the same with education. Here we are, we talk about, we're in a knowledge-based economy, and that access to a college education is about the surest route to have some level of economic progress in this society. By claiming a level of exclusion, what that does is to say all whites get access to the top-tier universities in the United States. And then if there's anything left over, then maybe. But we doubt it. That's what you're hearing in these ongoing, consistent battles over affirmative action, is, again, this fear of loss of access. And I talk about that in White Rage as well by really looking at the Bakke decision and how that Supreme Court said just a few years after the Civil Rights Movement, that affirmative action was not about redress of prior racial discrimination. So the fact that the University of Texas did not admit African Americans regardless of their qualifications for years was irrelevant. But Amy Fisher can say, but my father went to UT Austin. I'm a legacy. I should be able to get in. That's what we're dealing with. It is to strip history from its roots so that we just kind of look in this kind of snapshot moment in time and say, aha.
Carol Anderson, it was a delight to have you back on the Project Censored show. Thanks so much for all of your very important work, and we certainly look forward to speaking with you again.
Oh, thank you so much, Peter and Mickey. I appreciate it.
Thanks a lot, Carol.
That was sung by a prisoner during a performance in the Oregon State Penitentiary about solitary confinement. This prison performance inspired Within These Walls, a Portland community event. Here, Within These Walls, on Prison Pipeline, October 17th at 6:30 p.m.
I know why the caged bird sings. This cage is my stage. When I am on, I'm free.
Good morning. It's just a couple minutes before 10 o'clock. and you are tuned to KBOO Portland. Coming up on the Boo this morning at 10:15 on Flashpoints, host Dennis Bernstein speaks with journalist Robert Perry about the presidential debates, the U.S. media, and the danger of nuclear war, and will present highlights from Monday's Indigenous Peoples Day Sunrise celebration. And at 11 on the Dirtbag, host Glenn Andreessen and guest Jim Gilbert discuss the many different ways gardeners can use leaves, harvesting fall fruits and veggies, and Jim's garden travels to Korea. Thank you, KBOO members, for your generous support. If you're not a current member, you can become one very easily by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate Today. And next up, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre.
Good morning, Cascadia. Today is Wednesday, October 12th, 2016, and you're listening to KBOO Portland, your community radio, at 90.7 FM on the air and KBOO.fm on the web. Today's weather, first before we get rolling, because so much of what we talk about these days is environmental. And many of the stories, I'll tell you straight up, are chosen to remind people and to motivate people, listeners just like you, to take a stand on these things. We have so much to lose right now. Many people say that it is too late and that nothing